This is the second in a series that the good folks here are allowing me to speak on, in which my thesis is that the central fact in the gospel, the central fact of the Christian faith, is the death of Jesus Christ. I say that based on 50 years of reading the New Testament, and I say that based on explicit statements in the New Testament, such as 1 Corinthians 2:2, where Paul says, "I was determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified." My next thesis is that there are things in the life of Christ that are inexplicable except for the cross. To understand them, to interpret them correctly, we have to see them through the death of Jesus. And last week I talked about how I believe that the birth of Christ, the suffering there in Matthew chapter 2 with the deaths of the innocents at Bethlehem, can only be understood in reference to the death of Christ. And tonight I want to take another event in the life of Christ, actually two, that I believe must be interpreted through the cross. And I appreciate you being here tonight. It's good to see Al, it's good to see Patrice, and to see all of the rest of you. I don't think of you as guinea pigs for me delivering. Maybe guinea sheep, but not guinea pigs. And I appreciate the opportunity to go over these studies with you. I want to begin tonight by talking, prior to the temptation of Christ, about the baptism of Christ, and how both the baptism and the temptation of Christ are indicators of the end, predictors of the cross. So if you would, turn to Matthew chapter 3. Let's read verses 13 through 17. "Then Jesus came from Galilee to Jordan, to John at the Jordan, to be baptized by him. And John tried to prevent him, saying, 'I need to be baptized by you, and are you coming to me?' But Jesus answered and said to him, 'Permit it to be so now, for thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness.' Then he allowed him. When he had been baptized, Jesus came up immediately from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting upon him. And suddenly a voice came from heaven saying, 'This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.'" Now there is a huge disconnect in Matthew chapter 3. There is an obvious problem that John recognized. John's baptism was meant for sinners. John had no hesitation in telling the high and mighty, the notables who came out to check on him from Jerusalem, that they were a bunch of snakes who needed to repent. He didn't back down from anyone. But one day, as he is baptizing in the Jordan, he looks up, and standing there is a relative of his by the name of Jesus. And I don't know how John knew it, but John said, "There's something wrong with this picture. If there's any baptizing to be done now, you need to baptize me, not me baptize you." It's the same kind of quandary that Peter recognized in the upper room when Christ went around washing the feet of the apostles. And Peter said, in essence, "Lord, you're not going to wash my feet. This isn't right." And Christ said, "If I don't wash you, Peter, you have no part in me." And when John protested about baptizing Jesus, Jesus said essentially the same thing to him that he said to Peter. He said, "John, you need to do this, because it's necessary for us to fulfill all righteousness." I think what Jesus was talking about to Peter, "If you don't let me wash your feet, you have no part in me," and what he said to John, "This is necessary to fulfill all righteousness," was essentially saying the same thing, that the cross, Calvary, is involved in all of this. My death is involved in all of this. And you've got to see what I'm asking, what I'm doing in terms of my death. Now, of the events in the life of Christ that point to the death of Christ, I don't think any is easier to see the analogy than in regard to the baptism of Christ. Christ's public ministry began and ended with a baptism. He says, I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how I am straitened, constrained, until that be accomplished. Now, Christ was not baptized by John for the stated purpose of John's baptism. John baptized people, sinners, when they confessed their sins. He baptized them for the remission of sins. Mark 1:4 says that. Christ had no sins to repent of. He had no sins to confess. He was not baptized for the same reason everybody else was. But his baptism was one of those pivots, one of those indicators of what would happen at the end of his ministry. For what is baptism? In analogy, in symbol, according to Romans 6, 3 and 4. Baptism represents a death, a burial, and a resurrection. Exactly what Jesus would accomplish at the end of his ministry. Baptism is what I call one of those prophetic PowerPoints that were very common in the prophets. God tells Jeremiah to make him a yoke, a wooden yoke like he would put on cattle, and to wear that, to walk around wearing that. And people would ask, Jeremiah, what in the world are you doing with that yoke on your neck? And Jeremiah would say, this represents the fact God's going to bring Judea under the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar. That yoke was a prophetic PowerPoint, a visual aid. God says, Ezekiel, I'm going to take away from you the object of your heart's desire. Ezekiel said, that evening my wife died. And just like God told me, I didn't mourn her, I didn't arrange a funeral, I got up the next morning and went out and preached. The prophetic PowerPoints were sometimes very costly to the individuals involved. I see the baptism of Jesus as a prophetic PowerPoint. He took his place in the line of sinners coming out to be baptized. He was numbered with the transgressors, just as he was at the end when he was hung between two thieves. And so his public ministry starts and ends with, as it were, a death, a burial, and a resurrection. And the baptism leads us in then to the temptation. In chapter 4 of Matthew, verse 1, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. Then, Mark says, immediately, as soon as he came out of the baptismal water, he was driven by the Spirit into the wilderness. There is a close connection between the baptism and the temptation. I'll try to show what that is here in a minute. But let's first talk about what temptation is. And to do this, we'll turn to the writings of the brother of Jesus, James, in the book of James. If you'll turn to chapter 1, we'll look here at verses 13 through 15 of James chapter 1. The word temptation is used in two different ways by James, in the Bible for that matter. We have these two different uses of the same word in two verses. Verse 12, James says, blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts he anyone. The temptation James is talking about in verse 12 is very different from the temptation he's talking about in verse 13. The old King James said in verse 2 of James 1, count it all joy when ye fall into divers temptations. That kind of temptation, which is now usually translated trials, refers to the ordeals of the human predicament. The heartaches, the heartbreaks, the tragedies, the accidents, the pain we endure as the result of living in a cursed world. Those kind of temptations are to be endured. And we're to count them with joy because of what they produce, not because they feel good, James says in verse 3, knowing this, he wants us to understand something, that the trying of your faith works patience. When we know what those external temptations can produce, then we can react joyfully to them. Those kind of temptations are to be endured, but the kind of temptations in verse 13, 14, and 15 are to be avoided. Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from evil. Here's verse 14 and 15 of James chapter 1. Each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. Then when desire or lust has conceived, it brings forth sin. Sin, when it is finished, full grown, brings forth death. There are five things I want us to see about temptation from these three verses. The first is that temptation is inevitable. James does not say if you're tempted. He says when you're tempted. If you're alive, you're going to be tempted. If you're living on this planet, you are going to be tempted. If you're in a body, you're going to be tempted through your body. If you've got a mind with which to think, you're going to be tempted in your mind. If you have a job, if you have a family, if you have a social circle that you move in, if you have a church you attend, you're going to be tempted in all of those. Temptation is like taxes and death. It's not an if, it's a when. There is never an age we reach where we get beyond the reach of temptation. There's never a day we wake up to that temptation is not a real possibility. We're going to be tempted. Secondly, God never does this. God never tempts. Now, I want you to note some prepositions that we have in this text. Look at verse 13 again. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. That's the little Greek preposition, apo, A-P-O. Now look back at Matthew chapter 4 and verse 1. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. Same English preposition, but two different Greek words. The preposition in Matthew 4:1 is the word hupo, U-P-O. Just one letter difference, U-P-O, A-P-O. Christ was led up to be hupo of the devil. God never apos. He never tempts us. Temptation is never of him. Now here's the difference between the two prepositions. Hupo indicates direct action. Christ was led into the wilderness to be directly tempted by the devil. No intermediary, no go-between. It was Christ and the devil. The word apa in James 1:13 indicates something that is indirect. James' point is that God is so far away from tempting any of us, we can never even say that he somehow indirectly is responsible for our temptation. Verse 17, James 1, the only thing we ever get from God is what is good and perfect. Not even in an indirect way is God responsible for tempting. And tempting in this sense refers to a solicitation to evil, a seduction to sin. God is not tempted. God is not a tempter. Number three. Every temptation involves three elements. Two of them are stated in this text. One is implied. The one that's implied is that in every temptation, there is a bait. There is something external. There is something that is the object of interest. It could be a person. It could be a thing. It could be something abstract like popularity, or prestige. There is always in temptation something dangled out in front of us. Secondly, there is desire that is within us. Every man's tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust. You might yawn at my lust, at my desire. I might find yours completely boring, has no appeal to me whatsoever. You lock me in a room and stick a bottle of whiskey in there. When you open the door 24 hours later, that bottle is not going to have been touched. That is no temptation to me whatsoever. But other things are. The devil's been in the fishing business since the beginning. He knows which baits work. He knows what we're attracted to. And that's what he will dangle out in front of us. So there's the external bait. There is our internal desire. And the third element is that we feel drawn to the bait. We are allured to the bait. Every man is tempted when he is drawn away. That Greek word translated drawn away is found in John chapter 12, where Christ said, "And I, if I be lifted up from earth, will draw all men to myself." There is a pull, a magnetic tug in the love of God for us. And there is a pull, a drawing power that is resident in temptation. Number four, temptation always follows the same pattern. When lust has conceived, and that's a birth term, in conception, two things unite. And in temptation, for sin to be produced, two things have to be joined, namely the bait and our desire. And when we take the bait, the result is sin. And when sin grows up, it ends in death. And that's not a pretty picture. Now, I know Oscar Wilde, who was a witty man, a witty Irishman, he could joke about temptation. He said he could resist everything except temptation. He said the only way to get rid of temptation is to yield to it. He wasn't laughing at the end of his life. He ended very horrifically. And there's nothing pretty about death, but it's real. Sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. And then number five, between our desire and the bait, between our desire grabbing the bait, rationalization often replaces rationality. When our desire has been awakened and all we see in front of us is the bait, our common sense, our good sense, our logic goes out the window. Who ever thought teaching sex education in the schools was going to lower the out-of-birth rate? It was crazy. It doesn't matter how much you're taught. When desire takes over, your thinking goes out the window. And it's replaced by rationalization. And in rationalization, we are talking ourselves into the rightness of something that's wrong. After all, we're all human. I'm only human. I never claimed to be perfect. And we are finding ways to rationalize what we're going to do that we shouldn't do. Now, I'm not going to do it tonight. I've got it in my notes somewhere. But if we looked at the three temptations of Christ, we would find these three elements in each one: the bait, the desire, the drawing to the bait. The drawing that closes the gap between the desire and the bait. They're all present in the temptations of Christ. I'll let you look for those. But I do want now to turn back to Matthew chapter 4 and look at the first two verses, because each of these terms in the first two verses are so significant. Let me reread the verses again. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. Christ was led up by the Spirit. If you've got the idea that Jesus was being attacked by the devil in the wilderness, you've got the wrong idea. Christ was not being attacked. He was attacking. He was on the attack. He was driven by the Spirit into the wilderness. He was on the offensive. He was not defending himself, caught unawares, ambushed out there. He went out looking for the devil. What he does in chapter 4 is exactly what he's talking about in chapter 16, verse 18. Upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. That pictures hell on the defensive. An attacking army does not carry its gates with it. It's when an army or a city is attacked that they close the gates and they're hiding behind it. In Matthew 16, 18, Christ pictures the church on the offensive, and that's what he's doing here. He's going after the devil. And he's looking for him in the wilderness. The Judean wilderness leading down to the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, is the greatest geological evidence of God's wrath that exists on the face of the earth. It is an ugly, hideous scar. A half a mile deep. The bottom of the Dead Sea is a half a mile below sea level. And that rift resulted from God's fire and brimstone poured out on the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah, where God cauterized the sin that was in those cities. You want to know what God thinks about sin? The wilderness is the place to see it. In Genesis 13, verse 10, that area around Sodom and Gomorrah was so beautiful, it was likened to the Garden of Eden. And because of the sin of those cities, the fairest region in that area became the ugliest. And that's where Christ goes looking for the devil. And the word devil, of course, means accuser, slanderer. In what Satan says in these temptations, just like back in the Garden of Eden, he is implying accusations. He is implying slander. Christ was there 40 days and 40 nights without eating. That reminds us of the fast of Moses on Mount Sinai, Elijah on Mount Sinai. But I think the better analogy here is not that Moses and Elijah fasted 40 days, but that Israel was in the wilderness 40 years. The number 40, I talked last week about the symbolism of numbers. The number 40 in the Bible is the number for penalty, for punishment of sin. And so Christ is in the wilderness, same number of days that Israel was in the wilderness, same number of years. And he went there to deal with the devil. And there were three temptations. And trying to characterize these temptations, you can kind of get all over the board. I think one way of looking at the temptations is that in the first one, Christ was attacked as the Son of Man, in the second as the Son of God, in the third as the Messiah. The first one involved physical temptation, the second emotional temptation, and the third, of course, the temptation of instant gratification. And I think the first two are the key to everything. I think by the time the second temptation was over, and the devil knew it was over. Let's look at the first one, verse 3. When the tempter came to him, he said, If you're the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Verse 2 ends by saying he was hungry, and Satan is going to latch on to that as his avenue of attack. The devil rarely comes at an individual directly. Like with the first Adam, he doesn't say, hey, do you want to disobey God? He says, yea, hath God said, thou shalt not eat of every tree of the garden? You know, he's kind of comes in the back door there. And he does the same with Christ. He doesn't say, why don't you just go ahead and disobey your father? He says, why don't you fix yourself something to eat? And in the words, if thou be the Son of God, is the setup. Satan is not questioning whether Jesus is the Son of God. He admits it. In the Greek, the first class conditional sentence, which is what this is a statement assumed to be true. Since you are the, you know, this is a strange way for the Son of God to be. This is a strange situation for the Son of God to find himself in. God's your father, and this is how he treats you? He gives you the desire for food. He lets you get hungry, and there's no food coming. Christ is going to say in chapter 7 of Matthew, verse 9, that one of the jobs of a father is to provide food for his children. And you don't mock your children by giving them a serpent when they ask for bread. 1 Timothy 5:8, the man who doesn't take care of his own household has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So here is Christ, the Son of God. He's out there in the wilderness, and there's no food to be had. What kind of a father do you have? I think that's the insinuation. Some father you've got. And the devil comes to us with the same temptation. Anytime there is a legitimate desire we have for food, for drink, for self-preservation, the sexual appetite. Anytime there is a God-given appetite, but there is no legitimate means or way to satisfy it, what do we start doing? We start asking, what in the world is going on here? God gave me these desires, he gave me these feelings, and there's no way that I can satisfy them legitimately? And then we start rationalizing the wrong into a right. If God's not going to take care of the desires he gave me, I'm going to take care of them myself. And people day in, day out have to deal with that temptation of legitimate appetites not being satisfied in a righteous way. And that's what he hits Christ with. That's the bad news. You're hungry. Your father apparently is off doing something else. You're apparently not important enough for him to tend to you. But the good news is you don't need him. You can satisfy your desire yourself. Your deity, turn these stones into bread. And often when our desires, appetites that God has given us go unmet, there's a way not very far off for us to satisfy them ourselves. But Christ answers by quoting Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 3. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. And Christ refuses to abandon his humanity to deal with the crisis of his hunger. He came to earth, became flesh and blood, became us. He could have stepped outside of his humanity. Same temptation comes at the end of his life when they come out to arrest him. Peter draws a sword. Christ says, Peter, I've got all the angels I need to deal with this. If he had stepped outside his humanity, then he could have done so. But he refused to abandon his humanity. He's going to deal with whatever the situation is as we would have to deal with it as a man. And so that leads to the second temptation, and you've got to see the connection between the two. What happens in a marriage when one or the other feels they are being slighted? When they feel the other isn't treating them quite right? Or maybe the other is taking them for granted or is overlooking their needs? What often happens in a marriage? Well, the offended party often wants the offending party to do something to prove their love for them, right? You know, if you really love me, you would do this. I want some proof of your concern and care and love for me. That's what the second temptation is about. The devil takes Christ into the holy city, up on the temple, out on a wing of the temple. From that very wing, James, the brother of Jesus, James 1, 13-15, would later be thrown to his death by the Jews. And the devil says, you know, I can understand why you might be having some doubts about your father right now. After all, he left you out there. I remember when I was a kid, we were coming home from John Neve's one night. I must have been 5, maybe 6. We got a half a mile from the house. I could see the house up on the hill with the pole light. And we're talking back and forth. And so Dad lets me out for me to walk home in the dark to prove my manhood. And it was easy cut across the pasture up to the house. And you know what? Dad met me more than halfway. That's the kind of dad I had. What about when it doesn't seem Dad is coming? And you're wanting Dad to prove himself. Satan says, why don't you jump off? And this will show whether or not he really loves you. After all, you have his promise that he won't let you stub your toe. Why don't you just jump? And that'll prove it. The first temptation hit Christ physically, the second hit him emotionally. But he didn't jump. You know why he didn't jump? Because he had just said, I'm going to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Let me give you one of those words. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. And Christ believed him. And Christ put his trust in that. He didn't think his father would lie. He didn't think his father would give him a serpent or a stone when he asked for bread. He didn't doubt his father's. His father had just said, I love you and you please me. And that's all he needed. He didn't have to put his father to the test. You know, when you ask for a second opinion, it's because you've got doubts about the first one, right? Christ didn't need any second opinion. He didn't need any further proof. He was going to live by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And folks, it was over right then. I mean, I don't know if the devil realized. I think he kind of did. But it was over. Satan was not going to shake Christ loose from his trust. Last week, trust God. Christ trusted God. And Satan, I think in a panic, just pulls out all the stops. And the third temptation shows him all the kingdoms of the world and offers instant gratification. Just take a minute, bow down, worship me. You'll not have to go through the cross. You'll have all you came for. You want the kingdom. You want God's will to be done. You'll have it all. Just fall down and worship me. And Christ got fed up with that liar and told him to get out. Now, I've said that these events we're talking about point to the cross. What about the temptation of Jesus points us to the cross? Well, the temptation shows us the mindset Christ carried to Calvary. A mindset of trust, of believing His Father, of believing His Father loved Him enough that even if He didn't understand all that was going on, it was enough that His Father did, and He was going to rely on His Father to tend to Him and to care for Him. If Christ had failed the test here, what hope would we have had that when the heat was turned all the way up at Golgotha, that He would have passed the test then? I mean, this temptation was sort of a proving ground. And it was no sham battle. Christ was truly tempted. I mean, maybe the greatest indication of how the temptation was hurting, how the cross was hurting, was when Christ prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Oh, my Father, if it's possible." And then they put Him on the cross, and in the Gospel of Matthew, the only word from the cross that Matthew records is, "My God, not my Father, my God." But the last word from the cross, "Father, into Thy hands I commend my spirit." The devil tried to shake Christ from the belief that is at the center of the universe, that this world is governed by a loving Father, and he couldn't do it. I don't know if you ever heard of this guy, John Mad Jack Churchill. I don't know if he was related to Winston or not. He was a Scottish commando in World War II. He would go into battle with a Scottish claymore, a huge two-handled sword and bagpipes and a bow and arrow. He captured 40 Germans one time with his bow and arrow. He said any British officer who goes into a battle without his sword is not properly dressed. He said an assault leader should have a reputation which demoralizes the enemy while convincing his own men that nothing is impossible. Have you ever noticed in the Gospels how jittery and skittish the demons got when Jesus showed up? They knew what had happened in the wilderness. They knew what had happened to their leader. And like James says, they fear and trembled. They knew the depth of the defeat that had occurred. We need to be inspired by the victory that was won. And never lose our faith or trust in the love of our God. Thank you for listening this evening.